Good afternoon. This is Monday, February 6th, and it's about 1:35, and I would like the record to reflect that we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Thompson, Representative Guttenberg, myself, Co-Chair Seaton, and Representative Kawasaki has been previously excused from today's meeting. Before we start, remember your cell phones. Today we have Legislative Finance Director David Teal, and he will be presenting on a framework for analyzing fiscal plans. And Mr. Teal, would you care to come forward, put yourself on the record, please, and begin your presentation? And Mr. Teal, would you like to have questions at the end or as we go through?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division, and I prefer questions as we go along.
Very good. So members, just signify so that I will recognize you if Mr. Teal is going through a part of his question. I'll wait and hold the question until the end where he reaches a stopping point, but then we'll take him at that point in time. And Mr. Teal.
Thank you. You as legislators will be discussing several versions of fiscal plans this session. You got one, the first one, before you last week. And as time goes on, you're going to see these various plans and bills, and they have different provisions. Some of them are fairly complex. This presentation doesn't focus on any particular bill or plan. It stems from a discussion with you, Mr. Chairman, in which we were talking about the difficulty of comparing one plan with others. And the conclusion of that discussion was that presentation of one bill after another may not be the best way to, best route to consensus, you, at least not without a framework to help members determine what the advantages and disadvantages of various provisions are. So the framework presented today is simply four questions. And
before we go on to this, let me record reflect Representative Gren joined us.
Answering just those few questions can help you get to a basic fiscal plan. There are also options to consider if you want a more comprehensive plan, but to me this is like knowing that your Prius doesn't work very well for hauling lumber for your construction business, and you think you need a truck instead, and trying to figure out what that truck should look like. That decision is a tough one, but whether you need a truck at all might be the start of your discussion, and then from there you need to decide whether, you know, a half-ton two-wheel drive short bed is going to work for you, or whether you need a diesel-powered crew cab long bed with dualies. I mean, there are vastly different trucks out there, and some of the fiscal plans can be different, but bottom line here is that maybe you shouldn't worry so much about what color the truck is and whether it's got 20 speakers and fancy wheels. It's you can get those things with any plan or with any truck. So I would urge you to focus on the basics and not get bogged down in those optional add-ons to a plan.
And before we go further, let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Pruitt, and also Representative Sadler has joined us in the audience. Great.
Okay. So the first question is, do you want to use earnings of the permanent fund to help balance the budget? And here, you know from the presentation by the Department of Revenue last week that we're facing a structural deficit that's been going on for a number of years, and that the revenue forecast shows continued deficits. So I think you know how bad the situation is, but you also know that you have tools to address it, and those tools are cuts, taxes, use of investment earnings of the permanent fund, or using reserves. You also know that we have been using reserves, we have been cutting, but that now our reserves are declining rapidly, and that neither cuts nor taxes are going to be able to fill the deficits. So I think as a practical matter, there's no tool out there that can fill more than about one-third of the existing deficit. And use of earnings is capable of filling half or more of the deficit. And probably the most important thing about it is that using earnings would have far less economic impact than either cuts or taxes. That's because cuts or taxes remove money from the economy. Well, those earnings are not currently in the economy. So using earnings doesn't take anything away from the existing economic structure. Now, if your answer is no, I don't want to use earnings, then the rest of this presentation isn't going to be very useful to you, because it assumes that you've chosen to use earnings. And if that's correct, then your next question could be, as you use those earnings, put them in the general fund, do you want to have that transfer based directly on earnings, or do you want to use a percent of market value payout, frequently referred to as POMV? We know a couple things. You heard on Friday that governments and economies aren't very good at dealing with volatile revenue. For government, just imagine saying, well, we don't have any permanent fund dividends this year, so you shut down the whole division. And then next year, there are dividends. Restarting that is not an easy process. Government functions a lot better with stability. You know that earnings are volatile, and they can be negative. We've done what we can to remove volatility from earnings with the five-year moving average, just like permanent fund dividends use a five-year moving average of earnings. But you also know that dividends remain volatile. They've bounced between $700 a year and $2,200 a year. So we know that the balance of a fund is more stable, and that POMV offers greater stability than earnings can. Unfortunately, adopting POMV would change the existing method of calculating dividends. And I say unfortunately because there's not that there's anything wrong with a POMV payout method. I think that's the most common method used for endowments across the country, around the world. It's just that we've used earnings for a number of years, and I think there are a number of people who aren't looking forward to a change in the way we've done things. So it's more a matter of facing change rather than facing something that's a disadvantage. I don't think it is a disadvantage. And here's just a couple of graphs included to show you how volatility can differ. This first one uses 50% of realized earnings going to the general fund. And you can see that, I should say first, that in models that you may have seen presented, we show a steady earnings, 6.95%, something like that. When you assume a constant earnings rate, then anything related to those earnings is also constant. We know that in the real world, you don't always earn 6.95% every year. So this graph shows repeating the past 9 years of actual earnings and showing what the payout for dividends or for the general fund would have been. Now, it says payout for dividends in general fund, and there's only one line. That's because we're using 50% of realized earnings to the general fund and 50% to earnings. There's really a line hidden behind that one that you can't see. But if you split 50-50, then both of them get the same amount. You can see the volatility here in using earnings. There's jumps here of gains of a $1 billion. Well, if we reverse this and said let's start with later years and go backwards, you would have reductions of $1 billion in a year. Again, not great way to run government. Here's the same kind of thing with a percent of market value going to the general fund. You do not eliminate all volatility, but it's much less volatile than using earnings. Now, I could show you how this differs using statistical methods, but I don't think this is a new concept to you, and I hope there's no statistical arguments that need to be made about measuring volatility. So assuming that you select percent of market value as your payout method, in a bill you would have to specify a payout rate. This chart shows you what the payout rate or payout would be, and this is to the general fund, assuming we've got a $50 billion fund earning 6.95%. That's the permanent fund now and projecting those earnings into the future. Here are the different payout rates. 4% up here, then 4.5, 4.75, 5, and 6. What I hope you see here is that the lower the payout rate, 4%, the lower the payout right now. But of course, as you go through this, your payout is small, your fund remains larger, and that same percentage payout of a growing fund gives you larger and larger payouts. And over a period of 40 years, a 4% payout is going to be greater than a higher percentage payout. That higher percentage payout gives you more in the early years. So your payout rate is something that isn't as important, perhaps, as many people seem to think. We looked at a 5.25% payout. Department of Revenue said last year that was very aggressive. It is. They said on modeling in this year, more recent modeling, that we can make it with 5.25%, we think. But it doesn't have to be that high, and this just shows you that if you picked a lower payout rate, that it would pay less right now, but in 20 years, they all pretty much cross, and beyond 20 years, the lower payout rate gives you higher payouts. So just pick something. Anywhere between 5.25 and 4.25 works. What you're really doing here is trying to find a good balance between high payout and a safe payout. We know this. If you picked a 7% payout, it would start here at about $3.5 billion a year, but your payout would actually decline over the years because you're earning $6.95 and paying out $7. You can't do that. So your rate here is important, but 4.5, 4.75, 5, 5.25, it's just a balance that you can argue about, but that it won't make or break a plan. Next question is, how much should go to dividends?
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, so those are all numbers that people have talked about, somewhere between as low as 4.25 and, as you know, as high as 5.25. When you say those won't make or break a plan, what do you mean?
I mean that, through the chair, Representative Guerra, here these are nominal rates, so basically, it doesn't matter. If you pick a low rate, that means 4% payout now would give you about a $2 million payout. Okay, if you pick a much higher rate, the 5%, you're at 2.5%. So figure this, it's about $100-$125 million per year for each quarter point that you pick. You pick a slightly lower payout rate, you're going to have less general funds, which means there's more pressure to cut, or in some people's minds, more pressure to find some other way to fill that gap that remains, because you're $125 million shorter than you would have been if you picked a higher rate. Now, there's nothing here that says you have to have a constant rate. You could say, well, we're really in trouble now, and we got a few years to figure this out, so we want 5.25% for 18 and 19. And then we want 5 for 2 years, and then we're going to go to 4.75. This is all things that are flexible.
Mr. Chair, just briefly.
In
the range of things that are rational and relatively safe, would you consider that last statement that you said, which is we're in a crisis, and like right now is the crisis, 5.25% for the first 2 years and then go down to something like 5 after that, would that be rational in your view?
Through the chair, sure, that's a rational approach. You might say that a 5% payout doesn't give me what I'd like way out here. It's present versus future. And, you know, it's easy for all of us to say, well, let's worry more about the present, because that's the situation we're facing. The future's way out there someplace, and maybe we should leave that for somebody else to solve. So, yeah, it's a rational way to pick a high rate now and phase it into a lower rate over time.
Representative Ortiz, and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, in your calculations, when you're considering the benefits versus the positives and negatives versus a 4% to a 5.25% or whatever, did you look at our existing savings accounts and their ability to sustain a spending level, assuming there's still going to be a remaining gap there, long enough to get us to these higher payout rates, assuming we went with a 4.25% or 4%? In other words, did you look at the savings that the state has and its ability to offset remaining deficits up until the time we get bigger payouts?
Through the chair, we did, but when you break these issues down, like payout rates, this graph is designed to show you that there's a multitude of payout rates that you can pick. They'll probably all work. The question is, are you more concerned about present or future? And if you want to see how that works, you have to throw it into the model so that it can work with the reserves. This isn't going to tell you what we do on reserves, but I can tell you that a 4.75% rate starting now extends reserves and theoretically solves your fiscal problem, or most of it. 5.25% rate for a few years, as Representative Guerra suggested, means it doesn't really change your reserve balances, because you're paying the money out and burning those reserves. If you pay out less now, you're maintaining your reserves, but $125 million a year that's kind of connected to each quarter point in payout doesn't affect the reserves that much. I mean, it seems like $125 million is a lot of money, but the model simply isn't that precise. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the actual returns are going to be. You don't know what cuts are coming. You don't know what revenue measures are coming. So all of those things work together But the short answer to your question is anything above 475 extends the life of reserves. When you start getting lower than that, it's perhaps not quite as much as government needs to maintain its current level of expenditures.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have to have legislation to do a POMB, or can you look at each year, because we don't know what oil is going to be, we don't know what our other revenues may be? Does it have to go into statute, or is this something that we could do by the budget to be able to access this funding or use this model?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it does not have to be in statute. As you could see by the governor's budget this year, he includes an appropriation for POMV and essentially in the budget language says take your 5.25% of market value and transfer the money to the general fund. In fact, you also know that the POMV bill last year did not pass, but the governor's budget request includes a provision saying please transfer money as calculated in 17 to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, perhaps I'm getting ahead of the PowerPoint, but how have other, I mean, you talked about interest rates and variable interest rates and taking this off the political whim chart from one year to the next so that it's not available to the, and I know this is the hard part, to the to whatever is the cause du jour, for lack of a better term, on a legislative year. What mechanisms have been used in other places that lock a plan in besides just the will of the body? I mean, you have a constitutional amendment, then you have statute, then you have the daily budget process, the yearly budget process. But what else is available that has done that for sovereign wealth funds?
Through the chair, I think that some sovereign wealth funds may be able to, you know, if the government in Saudi Arabia, for instance, is basically a family-controlled thing, they may be able to decide those things. But for the state of Alaska, your choices really are constitution, statute, or appropriation language. As Representative Wilson asked, you could do this by appropriation bill. Absolutely. Does statute help? Statute provides guidelines and therefore provides some direction to future legislatures. Some people may say that is a better way to do it because that guideline is often followed by the legislature. But it doesn't have to be. It's just statute, and statute cannot bind future legislatures, cannot limit the legislature's power of appropriation. So a plan in statute is something that is nothing more than a guideline. If you want it to be something that takes away the legislature's annual discretion, you have to go with Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That kind of narrows the framework and, you know, looking for something. I mean, I think historically the legislature has a record of what it's done with the money available for appropriations, and the public doesn't care about the past. They just look, as we start touching it, that we're never going to get our hands out of it. But we do have to have a framework that something, that there are rules that people can look back and see that we had some, there were reasons for what we were doing and moving forward, whatever we do. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions before proceed? Seeing none, go ahead, Mr. Chair.
So your fourth and last question is, how much should go to dividends? This is not something that most endowments have to deal with. The money would be a sovereign wealth fund would pay out to the government. And you may recall that from last year, the consultants testifying about other sovereign wealth funds. We have dividends, and in deciding how much should go to dividends, it's not just a political choice. Higher dividends translate directly into the need for some combination of additional revenue or additional budget reductions or larger draws from reserves. And to show you that, and to bring up a little slider here on dividends, and you know, you can hear someone say that higher the dividends, the less you get for the general fund 100 times, but nothing sticks in people's brains like a visual. So that's what slide 10 is for, and I want to give credit to Alan Mitchell, who models, who developed GCI's model. I was talking to him about this, and he says, I've got just the slide. So this is some credit to him. I modified it to go with POMV, but here you are with a way to say, let's change dividends, what it's going to mean to a $48 million five-year average at this payout. There's our total payout. And right now, if you say, I want a $1,000 dividend, those dividends are going to cost about $675 million a year, leaving $1,850 of your total payout to go to the general fund. That's what's shown in this graph. $1,850 would leave you $820 million of deficit left. And that deficit would need to be filled with spending cuts, new revenue, or reserves. So here, as you increase dividends, you can see that, whole slider moved. Didn't mean to do that. That larger dividends, and this one just shows you where we used to be at HB 61, now with higher dividends. As I said, higher dividends mean lower payout. Lower payout means more cuts, more revenue, or bigger use of reserves. You can cut the dividends to, got a problem here. There. You can cut dividends down to pick any number, and, you know, as expected, that means much lower dividend cost, which means much more of your payout goes to the general fund, leaving you with a much smaller dividend or much smaller deficit that needs to be filled. So the key point here is that it doesn't really matter whether the dividends go through the general fund or are paid directly from the earnings reserve. As soon as you use the earnings reserve account to make transfers to the general fund, dividends compete with that transfer and therefore compete with other expenditures. And I may not have, I tried to make that point in my overview, but I'm not sure I articulated as well as I could have. I think some people thought that this competition had to do with the earnings reserve account being reclassified as unrestricted general fund. That's not it. It's simply the fact that you're using the ERA to fill a portion of your deficit. The larger deficit, the larger portion that you fill with the ERA, the less you have to fill from other sources.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But everything is competing right now. Is that not correct? Whether you're talking about the higher education fund that you see throughout the budget, you know, kind of backfilling what used to be general funds, the PCE, we got a whole, there's just a whole bunch of funds that we have. Over here, you have the earnings reserve over here, and then your revenue, and really everything's competing because to one group, this is important, to another group, this is important. So at the end of the day, everything's competing to fill the budget gap. And then the question then has to be, are we going to have residents through the permanent fund earnings, which affects their dividends, be the ones who fill the gap solely, or do we look outside to whether it's tourism coming in, whether it's, you know, mm-hmm. outside workers coming in? I mean, is that not really almost a bigger political question on who's going to pay to fill that gap more than just the competition between all the different funds that we currently have to our, you know, if we want to get into them?
Through the chair, that it's certainly true that every expenditure competes with another. K-12 competes with Medicaid, if you want to say that. But that it's important to understand that dividends are currently paid directly from the earnings reserve account. They are not counted as revenue and not counted as expenditures in the fiscal summary. Dividends are below the line, and so dividends do not currently compete with anything else. It's a completely different fund source, and that fund source is used for nothing else. As soon as you use that fund source, the ERA, to put money into the general fund, that's the action that makes it so that it should be very clear to people that if I've got a payout of $2.5 billion, I can either take all of it and put it in the general fund, or I can put more and more of it to dividends. The more I put in dividends, the less I have to pay for those other things, education, Medicaid, and so on, so that you really are changing the world as we know it when you start using money from the earnings reserve to transfer to the general fund.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And I understand where you're coming, Mr. Teal. I don't think the Alaskans quite are there because they felt with their dividends being cut last year that it was probably utilized for part of government, although it wasn't. You know, that misconception. And maybe you're going to get to this, but then where is the discussion of what it does to the economy? I mean, one of the big things we heard last year was what the dividends do for our economy, how it keeps it boosted when we're cutting a lot of other things. When in the plan, any plan, I'm not talking about any particular plan, does that become part of the discussion? And then how do we rate those different levels of whether it's hitting people who right now aren't on public service, you know, Medicaid or public assistance, but it may throw them into that area, or just even private businesses that have become dependent for what, for many reasons, you know, on certain monies coming their direction? Where do we have those kinds of discussions in any kind of plan?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think those discussions have to occur when you're answering this question. How much goes to dividends? Because that is, how much money do you want to go to the people versus how much services do you want to go to the people? And I don't think, you know, you'd have too many people answer the question in the same way. And legislators certainly have different opinions about it. That's a discussion that you as legislators have to have to determine the level of dividends and therefore the level of transfers to the general fund, and which supports the services that go out there. I can't answer the question for you, and I think that all of you will have different answers to that. I just, you know, the whole point here is there's a range of dividends, and that affects the range of transfers that you can have, which affects the level of government that you want or can support. And you need to answer that question before you can get a bill out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, David. Just while you're here, I guess I'm just going to ask you something that I wish the press would pay some attention to. But a lot of them seem tuned out to the fiscal plan issue. I've got liberal friends and conservative friends who say, charge me an income tax, I'm ready to pay, but that's not going to solve the deficit that's so big, right? So that could be $500, $600, $700 million, depending on how big it is. I've got friends who say, instead, let's do a sales tax, same amount of money, $400, $500, $600, $700 million, depending on how much you want to tax. I've got friends who say, cut the dividend, and as you've shown, that could be $1.5 billion, $1.8 billion, $1 billion. None of those things solve the deficit on their own. It's so big. I mean, is that fair to say? I mean, I'm completely frustrated with the press for making people think it could be one, two, or the other. But none of those solve the deficit on their own. Is fair?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't, with a $2.7, $2.9, $3 billion budget, whatever deficit, whatever it comes out to be, I don't believe you can cut $2.7 billion. I don't believe you can tax $2.7, and I don't believe that you can get $2.7 from the earnings reserve. None of these things on their own will solve the fiscal problem. In other words, fill the deficit. Some combination of them can fill the deficit, and you know, again, that's what you're here to debate, is how much needs to be done. Can you get by with just a basic plan that takes the money from the earnings reserve? Will that allow you to get by without an income tax or without massive cuts? Well, the model will tell you those things. The model will also tell you what things look like if you add in an income tax or if you add in cuts. But I'm not really here to run the model today. This is just trying to put a framework for analyzing some of these big decisions on trying to get a bill that's really addressing POMV, not the entire fiscal problem. Just once you decide that POMV is a huge piece, your biggest tool to fill it, that isn't enough. You've still got to answer some other questions to turn it into a useful tool.
Thank you.
Mr. Teel, I think, as I see it, we've got a couple of different questions here, because we were talking about dividends competing with other allocations. And we can see here, in looking at the split between what a payout would go to dividend and what a payout would go to the general fund. But in the other bill that we heard earlier, the governor's bill, the distribution all goes to the general fund, and then a distribution is made from there so that they directly compete within allocations. In other words, you're looking at, are you going to put from the general fund a certain amount of money into dividend? Are you going to put that into education, public safety, transportation, those kinds of things? And so we talked just a moment, but it was covered very briefly, about the current payout method where it goes right from the earnings reserve to pay the dividends, separate than the amount that is deposited into the general fund for general fund allocations. And can you address those two things, as I know there's some similarity you get to when you're talking about protecting the dividend, when you're talking about insulating that calculation from the general calculations of distributing general funds. Can you just go over that portion of this
sure.
question?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's part of what I didn't articulate as well as I could have during the overview. And I think that what you're asking now is, well, if we didn't run the dividends through the general fund, we know this, we got a payout of $2.5 billion. Okay, let's say you want to spend $700 million of it for dividends. That gives you $1,838. It won't make any difference whether the full $2.5 goes into the general fund, shows up as revenue, and then you spend $687 on dividends. What's left over for other programs is 1838. If you send this 687 from the earnings reserve account directly to dividends without having it go through the general fund, then the general fund will not show that 687 as revenue, and it won't show it as expenditures. There's no difference. What you get into the general fund is the 1838, exactly the same amount that you got if you run it through the general fund. So this is just a question about whether you want dividends to be on budget, which is a change, or whether you want to continue having them below the line, off budget. And I think you can see that it doesn't make any difference.
Well, Mr. Peel, I agree with you that the number-wise in the final outcome doesn't make a difference, but politically, when you are doing a budget on unrestricted general fund and you're talking about competition of money to allocate to different programs, whether that program is a dividend or whether it's education, then you're talking about a different calculation that has to take place around this table, because you have all the money in the general fund and now you're going to reallocate that within the general fund. You may or may not follow the distribution model that you've created. Nothing, as long as it's a statute, can force anybody to do that, but you put that political question on the table every single year when you have a budget that you're taking UGF and deciding how you're going to spend it, versus, it seems to me, versus a formula that directs a dividend outside of the general fund as a separate mechanism, that politically it's much more stable. And maybe that's, you're the finance guy, so it's not, maybe we're the political people that have to figure out whether that's reality or not. But that's been the case in the past. I mean, we've had the full ability to, with a majority vote, to take money out of the earnings reserve, and we haven't done that, and yet we paid out dividends out of there all the time. So I guess I'm, I think it's a question, one of the questions that we really need to answer in here is how stable or how insulated we want the permanent fund payout formula to be. So do you want to comment on that, or is it totally political?
No, Mr. Chairman, I would, because I think you hit it exactly. That's a political discussion. Mathematically, I can tell you it's exactly the same. It's not the same politically. Perhaps it should be the same politically, because the result is the same. But math is not something that people necessarily grasp. They may see it as I want my dividend paid from the earnings reserve. It's always been done that way, and it's safe. I don't want it going into the general fund, because it seems to me that if we run it through the general fund, it might get used for other things. Okay, the truth is, it's what you set up in statute, and assuming you follow the guidelines, it will make, and assuming, when I say follow the guidelines, that you determine that dividends are going to be $687 million or $1,000 a piece, that it won't make any difference where that money comes from. Because mathematically it doesn't, but to you and other members of the committee, that may be something you want to discuss.
Okay, thank you. Further questions on this slide? Seeing none, thank you.
So that gets you through the basics, and now you can start deciding on options. I'm just going to walk through the options here one at a time. There may be more. These are some of the big ones. I put revenue limit first because it is probably one that got a lot of debate last year. the governor considers it a very important part of the bill. And let me again explain that one in Excel. Here you have what happens with UGF revenue without a payout limit. This is not a time series. This is a single year with varying oil prices. And I'm not sure what happened here with oil prices. It got strange and went to some 1, 2, 3 numbers. That should be oil prices. I won't bother to change it. It's just a technical glitch here somewhere. But what you have in the model or in this graph is the non-volatile revenue. That's the non-oil revenue, essentially. And it's fairly flat. It does go up as oil prices rise, but it's not hugely variable. The green in here is the POMV payout. It's also given in any given year. That's a calculation. It's a fixed number. It's your oil money that depends on the price of oil. And at low prices, you have low revenue. And as price rises, you get more and more revenue. At low prices, you also have a deficit, the orange bars. Alexi says he can fix this real easily. If you want to take a brief at ease, might be easier looking at oil prices on there than
we'll take a brief at ease.
Okay, so what you'll see here is that as oil prices rise, oil revenue rises and the deficits shrink. And at some point, about $80, the deficits go away and you end up with a surplus. The governor says, no, that's not going to happen. We want a revenue limit included in the bill to make sure that we don't end up with a surplus while we're still getting this POMV payout. So we're going to include a limit in here that says as oil prices rise, at some point that you select, you will lose $1 of POMV payout for every dollar of oil revenue. At $1.2 billion, you can now look at this graph on the right. This has a revenue limit. Up to here, about $75, the charts are identical. But when your oil revenue reaches $1.2 billion, and that would be at this point, which is about $75, your POMV payout starts phasing out. For each dollar of oil revenue you get, you lose $1 of POMV payout, which gives you a flat line for revenue between, say $75 and about $105. Now, that's where the limit kicks in, and at some point, your POMV payout goes to zero, and you now get that surplus revenue again. But the surplus revenue is lower because you're not using the POMV payout. So unfortunately, and we discussed this last year, you can see that even at the limit, there could be a deficit. And people will say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why are we limiting? It's a little hard to see there. I can make that chart bigger. Oops. Here, even where it's flat, you're still showing a deficit. And that deficit goes away out further at higher oil prices. But it seems odd that you would have that. Now, some people may say, well, that's great. The revenue limit continues to exert pressure on the budget. We need to hold the budget down, cut the budget, whatever, in order to eliminate those deficits. Last year, some people said, well, the revenue limit's just a clever way of encouraging income taxes or some other broad-based tax because it's only oil revenue that's subject to the revenue limit. If you added a broad-based tax, which is not subject to the limit, then you would have more money to spend. That's something that you can debate. We know this, that the revenue limit doesn't have to be flat, doesn't have to be dollar for dollar. Representative Guerra may remember last year we were talking about a limit that's less severe. It wouldn't keep you flat. So if you did something like 50 cents on the dollar, that limit doesn't get flat. It extends POMV payouts way out at higher oil prices, and you continue a smoother curve. You eliminate deficits earlier. So that's one thing you could do. The other is raise the limit. If you did that, you eliminate the deficits earlier. So there is a limit proposed in the governor's bill. It may not be exactly the limit you want. It doesn't have to be fixed over time. For instance, the governor had a $1.2 billion trigger that he did not want to increase with inflation. Representative Guerra argued at the time that's not an acceptable limit. You've got to have some room for expansion. Valid argument, but remember that this flat part is not a time series, and that if you were to look over time, the limit wouldn't be flat, and that's because the POMV payout itself increases over time. And you remember the chart that I showed you with all the payout rates. All of those have increasing payouts year by year by year. So at any given oil price, you'll get more money from POMV in 2025 than you would have gotten in 2020. Whether that's enough to keep up with inflation is something you'd have to see. But the point is here that the choice of your limit is based on the payout rate that you choose. Obviously, a lower payout rate gives you lower POMV payments and larger deficits. So you might say, I need a higher trigger value than 1.2 if I'm going to respond to that. It also depends on how much pressure you want to leave in there to reduce the budget. If your trigger is set too high, your revenue limit becomes ineffective. If it's set too low, you end up with deficits in the future. So all of these are things that you can debate. then moving on to a spending limit, which some people might think is the same thing. It can be very similar to a revenue limit. But here it depends on whether you expect a spending limit to affect you every year, to be so tight that on an annual basis you are facing bumping up against the limit every year. You could set a limit that does that, but that's essentially what the revenue limit does. The spending limit could kick in after the revenue limit has exerted all the impact that it can give you. In other words, the revenue limit at very high oil prices still gives you this surplus revenue. That's where your revenue limit could kick in. It doesn't have to kick in so early. Let the revenue limit handle it for a while and then switch over to your spending limit. The spending limit really can be, or perhaps should be, designed to address windfall revenue, very high oil prices that were unexpected. The complications in setting a limit are severe. You'd have to decide what fund group you want covered, and this is critical because some people say, well, it can't be. Well, let's do just the UGF, the unrestricted general funds, because that's where the deficit lies. Other people would argue that if you just limit UGF, then you can switch the unrestricted general funds over into other fund categories. True, that has happened in the past. You could say, because of that, we want to include all funds in the revenue limit. But remember, things happen there that, what if the permanent fund does very well? Management fees increase. Say it's $50 million increase in management fees. If you're going to limit all expenditures and you're bumping up against that limit, higher permanent fund management fees mean you have to find $50 million to cut from somewhere else. So maybe you say, well, we don't need to limit other. Let's just do general funds, so UGF and DGF. Well, same issue. What if the university raises tuition by $100 million? Then you have to find $100 million of cuts somewhere else because you're limiting too much. That would seem to argue, again, let's just limit UGF. Well, then you're right back to, can we prevent the legislature from playing what some people call shell games? But it isn't really. You can't move money from unrestricted general funds to designated general funds without passing a law to do it. Designated funds are, by definition, something that is designated by the legislature for a specific use. So you can't just say, well, let's just reclassify $500 million worth of money and call it DGF instead of UGF. Cumulative limits versus annual limits is complex also. You're going to have to figure out what you do with tax credits. It's fine as long as you're going to pay minimum tax credits, but if you ever want to pay more than the minimum tax credits and you have a tight limit, you'll be bumping that limit. Any large expenditures, a gas pipeline, large capital projects could do that. And there are legal issues, specifically that you cannot limit the power of the legislature to appropriate money other than by constitution. So arguably a spending limit must be constitutional in order to be fully effective. So my advice on spending limits is that talk about them all you want, but you might want to put them in a different bill because it's a very complex topic that you may want to avoid in deciding what kind of POMV provisions you want. Here's what happens with the spending limit. The dark line is the spending limit that's in the Constitution right now. this green, the dark green, is our revenue and turning into revenue forecast. The blue bars are expenditures, and you can see that we have never bumped up against the limit. We came very close, but my recollection of budgeting during these times, I never knew you were that close to the limit. We simply had stopped calculating the limit because we'd been so far below it that didn't really think that we were perhaps approaching that limit as close as we were. Regardless, we're now far below the limit again, and if we have a flat budget, that constitution limit just runs away. Even with POMV, and this is sort of boring because it doesn't show you any limit that we're hitting. It's so far above that nothing's happening. That's even with a POMV payout. And here you'll see that oil revenue, this dashed line, never reaches the $1.2 billion revenue trigger, revenue limit. So we don't even have, under Department of Revenue oil forecast projections, we would not hit the revenue limit, the POMV wouldn't be limited, and together the revenue plus POMV gets nowhere near the limit. You can also see that if you held a flat budget near $5 billion, that deficits would be declining because the POMV is declining. So let me repeat this graph with, instead of the revenue projections, let's just assume that we had revenue like we did in the 2007 through 13 period. This is at 75% of that, but it follows the same pattern, just lower. Same way, this line is the constitutional spending limit, except let's assume that we had an adjustment factor of one half inflation and one half population. So the inflation and population adjustments would be half what they are now, giving you a limit that would have kicked in during those periods. And if we repeated a much smaller spike now, would kick in again. But here you can see that in 18, as you saw in the last graph, you have the regular revenue in green, plus the POMV gives you revenue up to here. As you go past this dashed line, which is the $1.2 billion revenue limit, the POMV will go away. At very high oil prices, there would be no POMV at all. You would have a peak that may hit your spending limit. And then if revenue fell below that, here we see POMV kicking in again, and it kicks in again here. So this is just a sample. It's not a projection of what we're going to show. It just says that a revenue limit works to cut off or reduce the payout, reduces the revenue available to you to spend, doesn't affect the peaks as much. A spending limit is really designed to cut off the windfall revenue. And, you know, that can get complicated, as I said, by legal and other things. And I'd leave it out, but if you insist on putting it in, I would much prefer a limit, and it's purely personal opinion, but I'd rather have a limit that tells me what I can do with surplus money, not simply that I can't do anything with it. So if you don't specify any uses, the surplus money will be swept into the CBR. There are lots of possibilities. This is just kind of a cascading thing of where surplus revenue might go. Repay some CBR, then you increase the capital budget for deferred maintenance, then you dump more in here. The order of these buckets, the proportion, all of that is something that may enter discussions if you have them on a spending limit. Turning to another option, inflation proofing. You may know that we currently have inflation proofing for the permanent fund. It's based on the CPI and goes in every year. As you go to a POMV system, there is no reason to move money from the ERA to the principal. That's speaking mathematically, again. The political perspective on that may be that you prefer money on occasion going into the principal because it's locked up. And in the ERA, it can be accessed. But again, mathematically, the ERA earnings reserve account is invested with the corpus. It earns the same money. It's included in the market value. So included in the payout, it makes no difference whether money is in the earnings reserve account or in the corpus to the workings of POMV. There is a four times method in HB 61 that transfers money when the balance is sufficiently large. You can do that, or you can just make appropriations from the earnings reserve to principal as you wish. HB 61 also changes the flow of royalties. Right now, 25% of royalties is dedicated by constitution to the principal of the permanent fund. By law, there's an additional 25% on new wells, meaning since 1979, and that's roughly $50 million, rising to 60 as prices go up. But that's currently going to the permanent fund. You could redirect that to the general fund. If you do, then you're reducing the value of the permanent fund, reducing the payout, and instead gaining that $50 million or $60 million, depending on what the royalties are, straight to the general fund. That's just a fairly easy choice. HB 61 also includes some royalties going into the dividend. That was really done to, it's not essential, but it was done to, in response to some people's belief that royalties reflect an ownership share, and therefore that should be counted as part of your dividend. You can do it or not do it. It doesn't make much difference. Royalties make dividends more volatile, but if you did a POMV with a constant share going to dividends, then dividends would lose much of the volatility. In other words, there are other ways to adjust the dividend. You don't need to put royalties there at all. But remember, the key point here is that higher dividends, once you use the ERA for the general fund, higher dividends means less money for government operations. So that's it for basic plan and options. And if you decide on a basic plan, and even can decide on and including some of those options, as we've discussed, you may be unable to fill the deficit in the near future and probably in the longer term, next 6-7 years at least. So then you might want to consider other things that are more comprehensive, like an income tax. But again, depends on how comprehensive you want to be. If you want to have the simplest POMV bill you can, then income tax is a complicated topic that you may want to put in another bill. It may be that you decide that you want to fully address fiscal planning and make income tax a part of this bill. Again, an option that's up to you. So that's all the options I have. I'm sure there are more, but any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Are there questions from the committee for any of the choices or any of the directions we could go? Seeing none, I think you covered the subject pretty well for us on those basic decisions to be made, and we'll look forward to a number of those options and seeing whether those are want to be considered by the committee as we go forward. We'll take a brief at ease. We'll come back to meeting here, and our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 7th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we'll take up amendments to House Bill 23, Insurance for Dependents of Deceased Fire and Police Officers. And with that, it is 2:45, and we will be adjourned for the day.